For our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service now presents... The Independent, Indie Week, read by John Federson. This week, the issue dated August the 27th of 2026. And we'll fade out great gently and get to our weekly issue. Quite a few long articles today. Start with residents push Durham to support tenant unions. Residents of two downtown affordable housing communities, that's Willard Street and Ashton Place, are pushing the Durham City Council to take a stronger stance on tenants' rights after ongoing issues with their landlord and property manager. At an August 6th work session, a handful of union members, along with Durham City Council member Nate Baker, asked the City Council to pass a resolution in support of the two tenants' unions, which are affiliated with the Triangle Tenants' Union and North Carolina Tenants' Union. At a work session on Thursday, council members debated whether to call out Willard Street, Ashton Place, and the building's landlord, DHIC, specifically, or consider a broader resolution affirming the importance of tenant unions citywide and encouraging housing providers, especially buildings the city helped to fund, to engage with them. At the time Willard Street and Ashton Place were first developed, the projects were lauded by local officials and national housing organizations for the collaborative spirit and commitment to housing for low-income residents and senior citizens. But in the intervening months and years, residents say the management of those two properties have not lived up to expectations. The tenants say they just want their voices heard by DHIC and the property manager, Community Management Corporation, after feeling like their basic requests were going unanswered. In November of 24, Durham resident Jason Pulliam died of heart failure in the Ashton Place laundry room. Deborah Davies, Pulliam's mother and a member of Willard Street United, is suing DHIC and Community Management Corporation for damages, alleging the electronic door in and out of the laundry room malfunctioned, preventing her son and another tenant from escaping. The issue is emblematic of routine problems that Willard Street and Ashton Place residents say they have brought to the attention of DHIC and now the City Council. Davies said, "We still got doors manufacturing." Representatives from DHIC previously told North Carolina Newsline that Ashton Place was not responsible for Pulliam's death. Yolanda Mitchell, a Willard Street resident since 2022, said at the August 6th meeting the tenants had presented DHIC with a formal memorandum of agreement asking for collective bargaining and a pause on no-fault evictions when a landlord terminates a lease or evicts a tenant without probable cause during negotiations. According to NC Newsline, DHIC denied that memorandum. DHIC did not respond to Indy's request for comment. The unions are also requesting quarterly meetings with DHIC and Community Management Corp to maintain an ongoing dialogue about these issues. According to NC Newsline, DHIC has agreed to recognize the Willard Street Tenants Union because of federal housing laws pertaining to the project-based vouchers tenants there use to supplement rent for that specific building, but denied its recognition of Ashton Place Union, where residents use tenant-based vouchers. DHIC officials wrote in a letter to the tenants of Ashton, "Applicable law does not require ownership to recognize any tenant union at the property. That being said, ownership supports residents' rights to join the union or any voluntary association they wish." During Thursday's work session, the discussion shifted from whether the City Council would support the Willard and Ashton unions specifically and evolved to a debate about broadening the scope of the resolution to include all tenants throughout the city, with an emphasis on public housing and publicly supported housing providers, which the original resolution states have, quote, a heightened responsibility to ensure quality, affordable housing, and to engage residents in good faith. In North Carolina, tenants' rights are limited, but the city and county have some latitude for implementing ordinances with developers that, quote, receive funding or financial incentives from the local government to build or operate affordable housing per state statute, like Willard and Ashton. At the August 6th work session, Sarah Venus, Director of Housing and Neighborhood Services for the City of Durham, said new standards for future property management deals are, quote, on my team's radar. During a discussion about affordable housing on the city-owned 505 West Chapel Hill Street property. On Thursday, Mayor Leo Williams and Mayor Pro Tem Javier Caballero suggested stripping DHIC and the two apartment buildings from the resolution entirely, wary of instigating or singling out specific housing partners in Durham, and instead adopting more general language that supports the rights of all Durham tenants. Caballero also said city staff and landlords need to do a better job of educating residents about their rights, particularly those in affordable housing, through organizations like DHIC and Durham Housing, where tenants already have stronger protections because of the project's public funding. Experiences with bad landlords have made many folks fearful of retaliation, said Caballero. Quote, we need to work towards calming and not toward, again, just agitating, because we are in a moment where everyone is agitated, and we have to do the work in this community to tone it down. Last year, the council adopted an ordinance that would prevent landlords from collecting rent on properties with imminently dangerous conditions. Councilmember Jesse Cook also reminded their colleagues that a similar discussion was had when the council passed a resolution in 2024 that specifically named Amazon and supported worker organizing at a local warehouse. Baker defended keeping the buildings named in the proposed resolution, arguing the moment was precedent-setting, given how few tenant unions do exist in North Carolina. Quote, if I could pick a different place with a predatory landlord, I would. But the tenants organized. They want to do this. This is either untreaded water, or it's only lightly treaded, and this is trying to slowly steer the ship and set a new course around the issue of affordable housing. Baker told Indy, we want permanent affordable housing and we want protections for tenants because that is not always built in. We can talk about numbers, we can talk about 60% of the median income, that is, but we also need to talk about housing stability to the degree that we are able to help keep families in their homes and not allow a situation where tenants are not feeling comfortable that they can organize in their buildings. Baker has been tasked with updating the resolution language before it comes back before City Council for a vote at the September 8th regular business meeting. Tenants at Willard Street and Ashton are hopeful that their fight will bring positive change to all Durham residents, not just in their buildings. Davies said following Thursday's meeting, I'm fine with it because we're still included. It still gets our point across to get changes made in our building and also with other buildings that are going through similar or even worse situations than we're going through. As long as we get it signed and it gives the residents a voice and brings us to the table. All right, we move to the North Carolina libraries system. Surging book demands. If you're someone who frequents a North Carolina public library, especially in an urban area like Raleigh or Charlotte, you might be all too familiar with searching the catalog for a busy book, only to find the wait list is hundreds, if not thousands, of people long. Local library employees say the entire country faces this issue, but North Carolina's booming population and the growing number of library patrons in the state make it especially challenging. Even worse than the wait list for physical copies is the one for e-book and audiobook versions. E-content has unique barriers, including costing libraries up to 3 times the price of a physical book, that make it difficult to keep up with the heightened demand. Yesteryear, a novel from 2026 by a debut author that examines trad wife influencer culture on social media, has been a viral sensation since its release last spring. As of mid-August, all 232 of Wake County's physical copies are checked out, and more than 1,700 people are on the wait list between standard and large print copies. At Charlotte Mecklenburg, 376 copies are checked out, and almost twice as many holds are in place. If wait lists get so long that the ratio of holds to total copies exceeds a certain threshold, selection manager for Wake County, Dan Brooks, told Carolina Press the libraries decide to purchase additional copies. For children's books, that's about 1 copy for every 5 holds, but the ratio is a bit higher for adult titles. Harold Escalante, Charlotte Mecklenburg's assistant director of collections, told Carolina Public its ratio for print titles is 4 to 1. Now, celebrity book club picks like Jenna Bush Hager's Read with Jenna and Reese Witherspoon's Reese's Book Club consistently generate long wait lists, especially if they're thrillers. Brooks and Escalante said others can go viral any day and take library managers by surprise. Brooks said some titles, like The Correspondent or Yesteryear, which did end up being one of the book club picks, just sort of build more slowly over time, but then just keep building and building with higher momentum. We just have to keep buying more copies till we get to that ratio. WCPL patrons might be familiar with the branch's Lucky Day collection. Each month, WCPL chooses 4 to 6 books to buy an extra 75 to 125 copies that aren't used to fill the holds. Instead, they are distributed among 23 locations to be put on this Lucky Day display, available for checkout then and there. It's a way for readers to get their hands on the most sought-after titles without having to wait for their turn on the hold list. It helps shorten the wait lists, even if by a small margin. But wait lists for the e-content often go above and beyond. In the case of Yesteryear, more than 5,000 patrons are waitlisted for a copy of one of the 452 e or audiobooks in Wake County. In Charlotte, for 580 e-books and audio, there are over 4,500 holds. Around 66 people moving into Wake County per day, the libraries subsequently have new patrons coming in to register for a card every single day. The heightened demand can be noticed most by that surge in checkouts for e-content. Brooks said, "We've definitely seen a huge increase in our digital book and e-book audio content. From 2019 to 26, it's been a 200% increase. We circulated around 1 million in fiscal 2019. And in 2026, 3.5 million. The whole issue with e-books and long waits and more demand than libraries can satisfy is not unique to Wake. It's a national phenomenon happening. Through migration alone, 135 people move to Charlotte per day on average, with Mecklenburg County leading the pack. Charlotte currently ranks as the United States' 14th largest city, and it could move up the list if growth trends continue. Population growth can impact the resources libraries have available. However, not every new resident will become a card holder, wrote Escalante in an email. It's something Mecklenburg considers, but it's not always a driving force for purchasing decisions. While population growth is part of North Carolina's story, President and CEO of the Urban Libraries Council, Brooks Rainwater, told CPP there's generally been more usage of libraries since the pandemic, so local libraries could still be seeing an increase in patrons even if their area is not experiencing significant population changes. Research in the ULC released in 2024, while in-person visits were still lower than they were before the pandemic, they were rising again quickly. The responding libraries reported a 24% increase from 2022 to 23. And at the same time frame, use of meeting rooms and digital resources increased by over 50%, despite lower attendance. Rainwater said, if you look at baseline numbers from coming out of the pandemic to now, we've been seeing more and more people return to the library. Also, we've been seeing usage patterns change where more people are renting rooms within the libraries. It can be really difficult in some branches and central libraries to actually find room rentals because everybody is going there to work remotely or using them to meet with friends or other things. Demand for digital items has steadily risen, especially since the pandemic. The challenge of keeping e-content available consistently is always going to be the increasing cost of digital licenses. ULC and other national library organizations recently spoke up about the strain the licensing process and cost of e-content puts on local branches. An open letter to book publishers says while individuals pay $13 for an e-book on average, which they maintain access to in perpetuity, libraries often spend upwards of $55 for a single 2-year license. The statement reads, many libraries are now spending 50% or more of their budget for collections, taxpayer funds, on disappearing limited access content, giving them less ability to support lesser-known authors and smaller publishers. Meanwhile, wait times for readers of all ages have exploded as libraries spend more to get less in our digital collection. Audiobooks of thrillers from popular authors like Stephen King or Ruth Ware can be more than $100 per copy, but most others are between $50 and $75. E-content is usually provided with metered access, meaning libraries can distribute the book for 12 to 24 months or up to a certain number of checkouts. Licensing is set by publishing houses, namely the Big Five, Penguin Random House, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, Macmillan, and Hachette Book Company, as well as e-book distributors like Hoopla, Overdrive, and Libby. Copyright laws function differently for digital content versus physical books, which is why the pricing structure varies, said Rainwater. Brooks said keeping up with expiring titles and purchasing additional copies to bring the wait down to a reasonable time frame takes up about 75% of Wake County's weekly spending, leaving around 25% of the budget for new titles. The cost can lead libraries to remove e-content from its collections if they aren't getting enough use. At WCPL, they track how many checkouts content receives and use that to help determine whether it's worth renewing for another cycle. Brooks said, if it's a title we've owned for 3 or 4 years but only checked out 20 times last year, that might not be high enough to renew it, given the demand of newer, more popular titles. So we will have to remove things from the collection on the digital side versus if you get print copies, they'll last until they fall apart, so they can stay in much longer than the 26 checkouts or 12 months. One advantage of digital items. is that they are returned to the library and fill that next hold automatically, Escalante wrote. Plus, they're never lost. This helps patrons move through the hold list more quickly than print titles, but still they have to think and buy strategically. To overcome some of the challenges of high-cost licenses, we make sure we are choosing the license that makes financial sense, wrote Escalante. We're also exploring some cost-per-borrow models to address demand quickly. Rainwater said wait times for e-content have gone up tremendously across the country. Library budgets cannot always align with the whims of reader trends. And if budgets aren't expanding, the hope is that book publishers seize the opportunity to increase access by making e-content more affordable for libraries. Rainwater said there's only so much money that can be spent on e-content, so wait times go up and up because we can only afford to buy so much of the material. The only way you can solve this is either to get better usage terms, better contract terms, rethinking the way we have our relationships with the big five publishers in particular, or if local governments want to spend more money on e-books. And to me, it feels like the amount we are spending now is more than fair. There's got to be a way we can meet in the middle. It would be a preferable and more responsible use of taxpayer funds for e-content to be licensed by number of checkouts instead of by time, Rainwater said. Otherwise, libraries are using precious funds for items they're not getting the full use of. He also suggests libraries having the option to pay a premium for older titles to keep them in perpetuity in order to build and sustain their collections. It's a misconception that libraries and book publishers are in competition with one another, said Rainwater. Libraries can be a first stop for readers looking for books to add to their personal library, or experimenting with a new author or genre before purchasing. Plus, they really have the same goal. Rainwater said, collectively, we in the library field, as well as the publishers, want to see more people reading. Libraries are a location where people come in and read and often buy books. It's not as though they come to libraries, only utilize libraries for reading. That is where the preponderance of people that do read go. We have author talks all the time, and then people go out and buy those books. So there's a misnomer within the publishing industry that somehow there's competition, rather than all of this is truly a complementary business environment where everybody wants to make sure people have the access to reading. All right, well, the next article is extremely long. I will cut large portions of it. It's historical in nature, but it also chiefly refers to Roy Cooper, current candidate for senator for North Carolina, and about the time before he was governor, and then he was a state attorney general at the time. And this is the famous Duke LaCrosse case. And again, I'll be making major cuts in this. The whole article can be found online at IndieWeek, as all of these articles can, IndieWeek.com, which is a free website where people can go and see the backlog and library of old articles, the initial articles, references, websites, links that I cannot give you in the print version that I'm reading to you right now. On a rainy afternoon in April 2007, satellite trucks lined up outside the 19,000-seat RBC Center in Raleigh, inside scores of reporters from around the country, including CBS Evening News, Katie Couric, settled into a makeshift press room. They trained their cameras on a wooden lectern bearing the seal of the North Carolina Department of Justice. A few miles away in a downtown hotel, three Duke University athletes huddled with their families, attorneys, and supporters, eyes glued to a TV. Audiences across the country were awaiting the news conference as if it were the finale of a years-long reality show, one that exposed tensions over race, class, and privilege. The Duke lacrosse case had featured lurid claims of sexual assault, candlelight vigils, pot banger protests, and dramatic testimony. One prominent blog called it Durham in Wonderland. For State Attorney General Roy Cooper, a Democrat who would go on to serve two terms as governor and is now running for the Senate, this was about to become the biggest stage of his career. By the time he stepped before the cameras, the case that had dominated headlines for more than a year had begun falling apart. Durham District Attorney Mike Nifong, who prosecuted three white lacrosse players for the alleged rape of a black woman, faced disciplinary hearings from the NC State Bar for how he'd handled the case. Under pressure, he'd turned the case over to Cooper's Justice Department, which did its own investigation. Cooper took the stage shortly after noon, he said. His office's investigation, quote, shows clearly that there is insufficient evidence to proceed. These cases are over, and no more criminal proceedings will occur, unquote. If that did not surprise many people, what he said next did. We believe that these cases were the result of a tragic rush to accuse and a failure to verify serious allegations. Based on significant inconsistencies between the evidence and the various accounts given by the accusing witness, we believe these three individuals are innocent of these charges. K.C. Johnson, historian from Brooklyn College, who co-wrote a book about the case, said Cooper's pronouncement was an incredibly courageous thing for him to have done. The safer political course would have been just to announce he was dismissing the charge because there was insufficient evidence, and then walk off the stage. Others were less enthusiastic. Duke Law School professor Jim Coleman, director of Duke's Wrongful Convictions Clinic, said this, "I don't think it should have taken courage, because I think what he did was the right thing to do. My criticism of him is that he didn't do that in other cases where I think it was warranted." Cooper has held elected office since 1987 when he was 29. He's a skilled politician with a knack for gauging public opinion and never getting too far out in front. On a few occasions in his long political career, he's taken calculated risks and succeeded. The Duke lacrosse case is one of them. Well, I'll have to give some details of this long article. Trinity Park, bordering East Duke campus, is a popular with faculty and students. In the spring of 2006, three co-captains of the lacrosse team lived in a rented white bungalow and hired two strippers on March 13th from the escort services. The women arrived shortly before midnight. One was Crystal Mangum, 27-year-old student at North Carolina Central. Their performance lasted all of 4 minutes. The players were angry. Taunts were exchanged. The women locked themselves in a bathroom. And by 12:30 a.m., Mangum was apparently passed out on the back porch. A player helped put her in the other woman's car, and they drove off before 1 a.m. Though Mangum would later give conflicting accounts, her allegation of rape caught the attention of police. On March 16th, Durham police executed a search warrant, and a week later, Corporal David Addison told the media, quote, "A brutal rape occurred within that house." That was the day Nifong, the district attorney, took over the investigation. On April the 17th, he persuaded a grand jury to indict three players, Reed Seligman, Colin Finnerty, and then Dave Evans. Seemingly, everybody had an opinion about the case. Many rushed to Mangum's defense and assailed the players. Protesters marched past the party house, chanting shame and waving signs that said castrate. A group of 88 faculty members ran an ad in the Duke Chronicle criticizing a campus culture of white, straight, male privilege. While some cautioned against a rush to judgment, others stood with the players. One was a brash Duke undergraduate named Stephen Miller, now a top advisor to President Donald Trump. That's right, that's Stephen Miller, who called the case a witch hunt and began making a name for himself on Fox News and CNN. Over the next few months, there were plenty of red flags. A police lineup of suspects that included only Duke lacrosse players in violation of Durham police policy, conflicting timelines, and a lack of forensic evidence. Nifong, who's white, was appointed district attorney to fill a vacancy. When the lacrosse case broke, he was running for re-election in a competitive Democratic primary with a large and politically active black electorate. At a candidate forum that April, Nifong said, "I'm not going to allow Durham's view in the mind of the world to be a bunch of lacrosse players at Duke raping a black girl from Durham." News and Observer reporter Joseph Neff, who had broke several major stories about this case, says Nifong forged ahead in what became a single-minded quest to confirm the woman's story. In mid-December 2006, the case caused a surprising breakthrough, in part because of seemingly unrelated reporting from Neff, and in part because of a decision Cooper made 3 years earlier. Alan Gell was a 20-year-old small-time drug dealer in Bertie County when he was arrested for the 1995 shotgun slaying of retired truck driver Alan Jenkins. In 1998, a jury convicted Gell of first-degree murder, and he was sentenced to death. But in late 2002, Neff and the News and Observer showed Gell could not have committed the crime because he was in jail for a different offense at the time. A Superior Court judge threw out the conviction. He said the prosecution had withheld key exculpatory evidence, including a secretly taped phone call in which the prosecution's star teenage witness said she, quote, had to make up a story. It was the first time a Superior Court judge had overturned a death sentence after just a hearing with lawyers. It left Cooper in office less than a year to choose whether to appeal the decision, retry the case, or drop it. Gell's supporters wanted him to drop it. Cooper chose not to appeal. He asked his top deputies to review the case to see if a retrial was warranted. They thought it was, and so he chose to retry it, though not as a death penalty case. Gell's attorney, Jim Cooney, said, "At the time, I was upset. In retrospect, it was the best thing that could have happened to Alan and our justice system. The Alan Gell case was the most consul case we've had in the state in the last half century." Gell's retrial took place in February 2004. A jury took just 2.5 hours to acquit him. Afterwards, Cooper called the original trial, quote, a travesty. "The original prosecutors in this case owe everyone an apology, the defendant, the victim's family, the community, and everybody in the state. An unfair trial occurred." Cooper became a champion of so-called open file discovery, which requires prosecutors to give defendants any exculpatory evidence. And in 2004, North Carolina became the first state to adopt such a law for all felony cases. An earlier law only required it in capital cases. Now, this law played a dramatic role in the Duke lacrosse case 2 years later. There was a pretrial hearing in 2006. Lacrosse players, families, and attorneys were there, and reporters and an unexpected witness. Brian Meehan ran a forensics lab in Burlington. Nifong, the prosecutor, had asked him to analyze 46 samples of DNA from Mangum and the Duke lacrosse players. A few weeks earlier, the judge had ordered Nifong to turn over these findings to the defense. 1,800 pages of arcane statistics and technical language. When Nifong put Meehan on the witness stand, it caught defense attorneys by surprise. In the ESPN documentary, Fantastic Lies, Seligman attorney Jim Cooney called it a brilliant move. Cooney said, "We hadn't come prepared to cross-examine a DNA expert about DNA. We had no idea he was going to be there." The lead defense attorney said, "We don't have a choice. We've got to move forward. If we don't, we're going to get killed." Eyes turned to young defense attorney Brad Bannon, who'd pored over those DNA records as part of the new open file discovery law, and he asked me in about the samples from Mangum. Is there multiple male DNA on there, he asked. Yes, sir. Does it not match anybody on the Duke lacrosse team? That's correct. Cooney took over and asked Meehan if his report had included the fact that no DNA from Duke players had been found on Mangum. Meehan said no. He had only included test results, not a summary of what the data showed. Cooney, and that was an intentional limitation arrived at you by you and Nifong? Yes, said Meehan, contradicting what Nifong had told the judge. Applause broke out in the courtroom. Johnson and his co-author wrote the judge looked momentarily stunned. The case had imploded at that point. Mary Winstead remembers picking up the call. Her colleague, Senior Deputy Attorney General Jim Komen, said, "You're going to regret taking this call." Facing an NC State bar probe into his handling of the case, Nifong had asked Cooper to take over in January of 2007, and Cooper, in turn, asked Komen and Winstead, a special deputy attorney general, to launch their own investigation. For 3 months, they worked out of a fifth-floor war room full of easels and whiteboards. They studied timelines, pictures, timestamps, DNA evidence, cell phone records. They interviewed police investigators, players, and attorneys. They talked to Mangum and found more inconsistencies in her claims. Cooper told 60 Minutes that April, "We can't see where she was ever asked the tough questions." He and investigators even examined the bathroom where the incident had allegedly happened, and he told Leslie Stahl, "It was very difficult for me to see how that could have occurred." In 2014, Conan told the News and Observer, "Their investigation persuaded them that Mangum had lied." "I was just adamant," said Komen. "She lied. She made up a story, and damn it, we've got to do the right and ethical thing." Komen told NNO that he and Winstead wanted Cooper to declare the players innocent. "Roy was absolutely appalled," he said, "at Nifong's conduct, which gave the North Carolina justice system a black eye." Cooper's political advisors cautioned against an unequivocal proclamation of innocence, saying it could alienate some black voters whose support he would need in future elections. In an interview with the Assembly, Cooper explained why he did it anyway. He said these inconsistencies were so significant and so contrary to all the objective evidence, there was just really no critical evidence that attack even occurred. They shouldn't have gotten into this position to start with, he said of the three players, but they certainly were innocent of these charges, and I thought it was important of me to say that. Mangum later admitted her claim had been a lie. She told an interviewer in 24, "I testified falsely by saying they raped me when they didn't, and that was wrong." At the time, Mangum was in a state prison for the second-degree murder of her then-boyfriend. A decade after Cooper exonerated the players, the Duke case would come up again. A banner hung from the stage at Winston-Salem State University in 2016 that said, "NC Attorney General Roy Cooper, Calvin Michael Smith's Black Life Matters." More than 100 students were rallying for Smith, a black man convicted in 1997 of a near-fatal beating of a white woman who had been in prison for nearly 2 decades. Wake Forest University student told the crowd if he's willing to intervene for 3 white Duke lacrosse players, he must be willing to intervene for Calvin. At that time, Cooper was in his 4th term as Attorney General and was running in the Democratic primary to take on incumbent Republican Governor Pat McCrory. Critics had long questioned Smith's imprisonment. A citizens' committee appointed by the Winston-Salem City Council raised doubts about the initial investigation. In 2012, former FBI agent Chris Swecker, who did a 16-month review of the case, concluded the police investigation had been, quote, seriously flawed, and that Smith deserved a new trial. He thought it was highly likely that Smith was innocent. Swecker had been assistant director of the FBI's Criminal Investigation Division, was chairman of McCrory's Crime Commission. Swecker and Cooper had worked together. In 2010, Cooper asked him to lead an independent review of the State Bureau of Investigation Crime Lab that ultimately found 230 botched cases. Swecker wanted Cooper to drop the charges against Smith. He said he tried to present his findings to Cooper, didn't get anywhere. And he told the assembly it was a miscarriage of justice, and that was what I tried to convince him. It was my hope that Roy Cooper, who had trusted my judgment in the past, would trust it on this one. Asked how he would reconcile Cooper's action in Duke LaCrosse case and lack of action on Smith, he said, I can't reconcile it. Smith was released by a Forsyth County judge in 2016 after his lawyers filed a motion saying his trial attorney neglected to present evidence that likely would have led to a shorter sentence, and Smith died in 2023. Smith declined to comment on any specific case. Each case is different. Some defense lawyers say prosecutors are naturally reluctant to recognize innocence. To Jamie Lau, supervising attorney for Duke University's Wrongful Convictions Clinic, that reluctance is, quote, endemic to the institution. They defend these convictions no matter how horrific they look today. In the attorney general's office, Cooper did the right thing in the Duke case, but the office itself has defended cases that proved to be wrongful convictions. Since 1989, 78 wrongfully convicted people in North Carolina have been exonerated, according to Marcus Pollard, an analyst with the Wilson Center for Science and Justice at Duke Law. Cooper has run for statewide office 6 times and never lost, projecting steadiness and competence. Rob Christensen, political reporter who has written several books about North Carolina politics, over the arc of his political career, I can think he proved himself a very cautious and careful politician who doesn't take risks. Obviously, there are exceptions. We can guess exceptions. All right, and I'll finish but this article. Cooney, the lawyer for one of the Duke players, has a nuanced view of Cooper. There's no question he's cautious, but he wants to consider what the consequences of actions are going to be. He didn't right every injustice we had, but what he did in the Gale case and the Duke LaCrosse case was as consequential as any criminal case in my lifetime in this state. So again, this full article, which I've given you about 3/4 of it, is available on IndyWeek.com if you wish to read or hear the whole thing. All right, we can next go to arts and culture, article by Brian Howe. This one is about the Carrack Gallery. And he writes, of all the Durham galleries that have come and gone, the Carrack Modern Art holds a special place in my heart, and I'm sure many people would say the same. Partly because it's the malleable moment that Carrack was born into in a creaky upstairs storefront on Paris Street in 2011, a city in flux between revitalization and gentrification, a downtown riddled with empty space for artists to fill until prices climbed. But mainly, it's because of how the Carrack met that moment, a volunteer-run community gallery that took no commission fees. It featured more than 1,000 artists and some 150 exhibits in less than a decade. For many, it was their first real show or a stepping stone to the next level. The Carrack's inclusive philosophy, busy social calendar, and embrace of performing arts like dance and poetry bred a rare vitality. It was the place to be on Third Friday Art Walks. Both anchor and lightning rod, it gave a developing art scene a place to figure itself out. Sabotage will tell you. Today, her CV lists dozens of exhibitions, honors, and residencies. But when she first met Carrack director Laura Ritchie 15 years ago, Taj was toting around burned CDs of her paintings, feeling at the latches of the art world. She said by phone from her home in Chapel Hill, having a solo show at the Carrick was a big step in my career and in entering the Durham art scene, which felt both tight-knit and big to me. The work I was creating got bigger because of the comfort I had with that space and with Laura, who I trust as a whole human. It just feels like a big part of my story. Not only did Taj become a Carrick regular, but when Richie chose to step down in 2018, Taj stepped up, running the space with the artist activist collective Durham Arts Movement. Excuse me, that's the Durham Artists Movement. By then, the magic window had closed. The Carrick had left the heart of downtown for a building near Golden Belt in 2016 when a countywide revaluation raised property prices by almost 10%. Richie said even really gracious landlords were suddenly looking at much higher bills, so a model like the Carrick didn't work in the new Durham. That gallery closed in 2019, but its legacy will resume this fall when Taj becomes the first artist to have a solo exhibit at Boarding House Arts. They open on Trinity Avenue coming up in September. It represents Richie's return to a public role in art after 8 years away, this time partnered with her wife, Shirlette Ammons, the widely celebrated poet, musician, and Peabody-winning producer. In fact, all four of the currently scheduled exhibits come from Carrack staples, casting a warm glow of continuity over the endeavor. But like the Carrack, Boarding House Arts is trying to meet Durham where it is now, meaning that in some ways it won't be like the Carrack at all. On a tour of the big, cheery pink box on 703 West Trinity Avenue, Richie is bouncing on her heels. Sure, she's excited about the impending opening, 5 years in the making, but really, it's because she's cradling May, whom Ammons keeps cooing over mid-sentence. Their three-month-old daughter smiles sleepily for a little while, and then promptly conks out, while we explore the three levels of the building. The basement will contain a surprising thing to find in an art gallery, a recording studio. Ammons said, "This is basically my domain." Stepping into a concrete hallway where soundproof doors divide recording spaces from an open live room with plans for a speakeasy in one corner. Ammons says it's quaint, but it'll be, for lack of a better word, boutique. She's designing the studio in consultation with pros like Chris Berner of His Golden Manager. And Sound Pure Studios. Everything will be hand-selected, from synths to high-end mics. Our goal ultimately is to do music education and make this available to people who don't have the bread to pay $500 a day at a big-name studio. Ammons also wants it to be used as a listening room and for poetry readings and recording podcasts. That's a world she ventured into with Tending via the Southern Foodways Alliance, exploring USDA discrimination against black farmers. She hopes to inaugurate the studio with her next album. That's a follow-up to 2024's acclaimed Spectacles. Lord willing, the creek don't rise, that's the idea, she said. The top floor, connected by an elevator and a metal stairway that winds upward through a spacious, newly built balcony, contains 10 studios for rent to all kinds of creative professionals, from artists to architects. These will not only provide a steady revenue stream, but also infuse the Boarding House with another layer of life. Richie said there's space for performers that originate in the basement to happen up in the gallery, or artists working upstairs to access audio equipment in the basement. We're hoping there's a lot of blending happening across all three floors. And the gallery is on the main floor, where big picture windows are framed in colorful stripes of reclaimed wood, and the expected pressed tin ceiling stretches above white walls. The century-old building originally had a grocery downstairs and a boarding house upstairs. That furnishes the gallery's name. Richie said, "We like the idea of a place where people from different backgrounds, working in different disciplines, can find home and come together and collaborate to historically gather around a table." The building has been vacant for decades. Hammonds and Ritchie bought it in 2021 and began renovations with architect Morgan Strider Haynes. It was a COVID project. Ritchie had finished her Duke master's degree in liberal studies with a focus on artist communities and gentrification, and Ammon's gig work had dried up. Ritchie said, "We were like, if the world's going to end, let's go down building. Let's build the thing we can uniquely build, try to make the life we want, and provide the resource we've been advocating for." They thought they could open in a year, but God willed and the creek rose, said Ammons. When they had the basement dug out, they knew the site was built on contaminated soil, but they did not realize the extent of the excavation they faced. Every time the pit filled up with rain, they had to pay to have the water pumped out and trucked away in order not to pollute surrounding areas. Ritchie said, "We safely removed over 568 tons of soil and 43,000 gallons of contaminated water." That alone ate up a year, but this was about doing things right, about laying the foundation for something that would last. Boarding House opens on September 19th with national hip-hop and performance artist Mickey Blanco as DJ. An example of the possibilities bred by Ammon's music connections. The premier exhibit will be drawn from Ritchie and Ammon's personal collection, representing artists likely to have solo shows in the future. Ritchie explained, "Just to seed the culture of collecting and introduce ourselves to the community, saying, look, this is the kind of work we've already invested in." Then Taj's show will follow in late October. Taj is known for large, iconic-looking paintings that blend figurative and surrealist imagery at the nexus of Islam, femininity, and queer expression. But she says her new work, which we'll see at Boarding House, is probing into subtler, more open-ended terrain. She's still developing that exhibit, but expects its loose theme to be memoir and memory in the digital age. Quote, "I started out really telling stories in a very legible language. A Muslim woman with a hijab is pretty like, okay, I know what we're talking about. Over time, it feels to me I can tell a true story if it's not static, if it remains in motion, if it's not fully clear-cut." Next will come a duo show by interdisciplinary artists Antoine Williams and Meg Stein, both CARAC regulars. Stein is also connected to Taj and Ritchie through the social justice-focused activist group Ain't Art Innocent. Art Ain't Innocent. Then comes New York's Gracie Lawrence, a favorite of Ritchie's from the old days. That fills the calendar through May. Because unlike the CARAC's rapid 2-week turnover, Boarding House shows will last 6 to 8 weeks. Ritchie, that comes from making artists in the community. People I worked with at the CARAC who 10 years later are showing outside of Durham, making their way into museum collections, and people aspiring to that. And unlike the CARAC, Boarding House will take commission fees, providing services in return, writing, pricing, installation, and the like. And Ritchie said the CARAC was never set up as a financially viable business, and artists were expected to do all the work. It worked for as long as it did because there were a ton of people who believed deeply in it. Here, I do think it makes sense for us to be mutually invested in financial success as well as emotionally and spiritually. Taj remembers the freedom and nurturing that came with the CARAC, but also the overwhelming labor of staging shows in addition to making art. If the CARAC helped a generation of artists find their footing, Boarding House aims to help those same artists take the next step. Taj, We need people in the artistic ecosystem, not trying to extract from artists, but to support them with the same vigor they're putting into their work. The longer exhibits are going to give more people time to come out, and it feels good for there to be a high, but not unreachable bar for artists. As Richie and Taj both point out, Durham artists are nothing if not resourceful, and the Carrick spirit has lived on in places like Perfect Lovers, Shadowbox Studio, PS37, now the Boom Club, and North Star Church of the Arts. And the city has fine exhibition spaces like Ella West Gallery, which happens to be currently undergoing its own exodus from Parrish Street. And Richie says, we have some great spaces, and we need more. After serving as the Carrick's self-effacing steward, she's keen to take on a more direct curatorial role. She's earned it. I feel like I have something to say, she conceded. There will be times when we open it up and do wild floor-to-ceiling community shows. I also plan to invite in guest curators. But I'm excited to be the creative leader of this exhibition center. I hope it creates a place for community the way the Carrick did. And we'll still have a lower-end commission rate because that's how we roll. So, boarding house is not the Carrick in that it's built to last. Me and Laura have been parts of the arts community in Durham for decades, and we have this little one now, Ammons said, peeking down at May. So this is just our way of putting down roots in a place that's nurtured us so much. Because this is the community that raised us, added Richie. All right, folks, get ready for our little ride to the end of the show. John Fetterson will say so long, telling you that I've not been able to read at least two or three articles from the current Indie Week, one about the Hayti Heritage Center in Durham, and another about the Lump Gallery in Raleigh, which is changing to the Plum Interdisciplinary Arts Space. And reminding that IndieWeek.com is your online source for all of these articles, including websites, a backlog of articles, and more. We plan this program for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners, and it's from the North Carolina Reading Service, which urges you to stay tuned for all of our programming. We're online at ncreadingservice.org. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We will be with you next week. Bye-bye.